This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. We are less than 2 weeks into 2014, and it's already been busy on the international news front. A former U.S. Defense Secretary is making news for his forthcoming memoir that's critical of his former boss, the current President of the United States. Plus, there are signs that the Egyptian people may be adapting to the country's less democratic military leadership. But our foreign policy contributor Art Sear looks first at Asia today, where a former NBA basketball player is continuing his unique and unlikely role as a would-be ambassador to North Korea. Dennis Rodman and a group of fellow former NBA athletes played a game this week in North Korea in honor of leader Kim Jong-un's 31st birthday, much to the chagrin of both government and basketball officials in this country. But Sear, who's director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College, tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke that despite the swell of publicity surrounding Rodman's link with the closed-off country, the trip itself probably has little impact on the frosty relationship between Washington and Pyongyang.
I think there's curiosity and sensational media, mostly tabloid value, but no, I don't think so. And in fact, there are indications that Kim Jong-un and coterie, the ruling clique in Pyongyang, North Korea, they've been keeping their distance personally from Dennis Rodman, which is certainly a good sign of good sense on their part.
Is this basically, as far as foreign policy goes, essentially just a weird sidebar?
Yes, I think it's a weird sidebar. Celebrities can play a role in foreign policy. Charles Lindbergh, for instance, greatly complicated U.S. foreign policy thanks to his, in some ways, favorable views of the Third Reich many, many years ago. In more recent times, it's hard to think of a sports figure or an entertainment figure. They're always in the news and want to be, but it's hard for me to think of a comparable example of someone, including, you know, very tangible aviation and engineering and science professions who've had a major impact on foreign policy. And he certainly doesn't qualify. But we live in a celebrity culture. The media is, if anything, even more celebrity-focused in terms of what should be the serious media than was the case in the 30s and 40s and 50s. So I think he's a good indicator of how things have changed for better and for worse. But I don't see him having any influence, and I'm very glad that even the Pyongyang regime, which seems to be removed from reality, is not giving him a lot of personal attention.
It's interesting, though, because you think back to the days of the Cold War and the Soviet Union, and we think of the cultural exchanges, which may have thawed the relationship just a bit. Can culture play any role, do you think, in changing our relationship with North Korea, or is it really just such a personality issue coming from the leadership in Pyongyang?
Well, that's a very interesting and very important point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're making a very important distinction between the kind of desperate celebrity, where I'd put Mr. Rodman seeking attention and probably income at this point in his career, and more serious cultural and educational exchanges. During the height of the Cold War, Dwight Eisenhower and associates initiated some athletic exchanges, but especially cultural exchanges. So the New York Philharmonic would go to Moscow, and Leonard Bernstein, the right kind of celebrity overseas, would have a very positive impact along with his associates. The Bolshoi Ballet would come to the U.S. That and scientific exchanges. There was something much less visible called the Pugwash Conference. But without compromising national security or nuclear secrets or anything else, scientific exchanges were encouraged by the Americans. And like a lot of other things that Ike did, an underappreciated president at the time, increasingly appreciated, at least in the intellectual communities, those were very, very effective ways of encouraging understanding between the two sides, because music and the arts are a universal language, and science especially is a universal language. That's a very good point, Mr. Tyke. I should be interviewing you.
But you would make the argument that Dennis Rodman is no Leonard Bernstein.
No, absolutely not.
Well, you mentioned...
And I'd hate to see him in a ballet costume.
You mentioned Dwight Eisenhower, and that's as good a segue as any. You have in the past compared the leader of South Korea to Dwight Eisenhower, just in terms of being kind of an under-the-radar, quietly competent kind of leader. The president of South Korea held a news conference on Monday. What, if any, news came out of that?
The good news is no news. Park Yeon-hee, she symbolizes important things, just as Eisenhower, for the average person at home and abroad, I think very much personified the best aspects of the U.S. And he used that very shrewdly to further his fantastically successful political career. She personifies in many ways the remarkable changes in South Korea. Her family history is in some ways tragic. She became the first lady of South Korea. Her father was Park Chung-hee, longtime, very strong and feared dictator. Her mother was killed by an assassin from North Korea who was aiming at him. She, as a very young girl, I think she was 11 or 12 or something, undertook the ceremonial aspects of that very traditional society. The fact that she's a woman, the fact that she won an open and free democratic election, the fact that she personifies all kinds of progressive things, especially as a counterpoint to her effective but very autocratic father, I think shows a lot of change in South Korea.
Well, and China's obviously the giant in Asia, and for years we've heard about our trade relationship with China and the kind of outsized importance it's taking. Japan has been a historical major trading partner of the United States. Why would you argue that South Korea is so important to our foreign policy and world trade?
They're a particularly close ally of the United States dating from the Korean War, 1950 to 53, a very bloody war, a war that Eisenhower very effectively ended very quickly, but one that had drained sort of the emotional as well as economic resources of the United States. It fostered anti-communist hysteria in this country in the McCarthy period. It made the Cold War, which had been focused on Berlin and Germany, global. It also cemented a tremendous close alliance between the U.S. and South Korea. I first became aware of South Korea in a direct way in the early 70s when I was in the U.S. Army. The ROK Army, Republic of Korea's Army, is a very, very ferocious population of warriors. They maintained 50,000 troops throughout the height of our involvement in our long Vietnam War, only because of tremendous affinity for the United States. And I've, over the years, been impressed at how close this relationship is and how much South Korea represents a phenomenal success story for the people there as well as the people here. We Americans should be very, very proud of what has been accomplished in South Korea, starting with that terrible war.
Let's shift to the Middle East, if we could. And there are reports out of Egypt this week. I think the Washington Post reported, for starters, on signs that the population in Egypt is kind of getting used to the military leadership that has taken over and kind of turned back, dialed back the, right, the democratic progress that had been made, and signs that people are choosing that stability over the freedoms that they had fought for and at least briefly enjoyed. What are you seeing out of Egypt, and how does that speak to the overall legacy of the Arab Spring?
The Arab Spring is still unfolding. I think it's part of a global movement toward democratic and free economic institutions that South Korea especially represents, but it's a worldwide phenomenon. Americans want instant results, and we tend to think that everybody in the world wants to be an American. I believe strongly that was part of our problem in Vietnam, which we mentioned a minute ago, and in our invasion of Iraq, which I think was misguided. Coptic Christians, one litmus test, a sort of canary in the coal mine, if you will, in the Middle East is how Christians are treated, and the generals have been rather restrained. They say, at least, they give lip service to returning to democracy at some point. No countries in that region have a strong democratic tradition outside of Israel and Turkey. So I think it depends. We should pay close attention to how minorities, especially Christian minorities, are treated in Egypt and elsewhere, and see how things unfold. But we should not in any way do what we like to do, which is lecture other people and send anything beyond economic and very physical aid and assistance. We shouldn't intervene in human terms politically in Egypt or anywhere else in that region.
Well, what about Egypt's leadership role in the broader Middle East? How is that being affected by having the military leadership in place there?
That's a very good question. It's kind of a return, as you were indicating, a kind of a return to the past. Geographically, they're extremely important because of the Suez Canal. Geography remains fundamental to international relations. And again, in contrast to our British friends and a number of others, we Americans often because we're so in love with technology and I believe so full of ourselves historically, we tend to often to minimize the importance of geographic factors. But the Middle East, and especially Egypt because of the Suez Canal, will continue to be in physical terms important for us. One important piece of good news is the remarkable energy revolution going on in this country. Our European friends will continue to be dependent on Mideast oil, but we are becoming far, far less dependent on foreign oil than we were. We're returning to a situation before about 1960, 61, when we had a lot of energy independence in terms of petroleum.
One more foreign policy development in just recent days, I think, bears talking about, and that is, you know, we don't normally talk about the publishing world in this segment, but why is a memoir that is not even out yet causing such a buzz in foreign policy circles?
Robert Gates, former defense secretary, his new memoir. Well, it's been leaked a lot to the media. He made what in retrospect is a telling public statement when he was leaving as Secretary of Defense. He said, "I'm not going to comment on my tenure. I want to do that when I'm going to get paid for it." I believe it's unfortunate that he's done a book that apparently reportedly deals so much with personalities. I think he's hurting himself in the long term. I'm sure he'll make a lot of money and generate a lot of controversy, but I'm sorry about that myself.
The flap in question this week has been his recounting of kind of a lack of conviction by President Obama over his own Afghanistan policy.
I don't think that's really a surprise. That's what the media has seized on. What's been quoted in the press, Bob Woodward, who's incredibly effective at getting sources to talk to him, senior people to talk to him now since Watergate for many years. I have read what he's written on the subject for the Washington Post, and Gates focusing on personal foibles of these colleagues of his, I think, is much more noteworthy and very, very unfortunate.
Given that the President Obama obviously cannot run for re-election, would you imagine that a kiss and tell memoir is likely to have any kind of legs as far as impact on elections down the road?
Probably not. I think these kinds of books have a very short shelf life and tend to have very little impact, especially when you do something like this when the president's still in office. Gates isn't by any means the first to do this. I can't think of anyone who's profited.
I would imagine he'll have plenty of appearances on talk shows, though.
Probably. He's taken a good new job, head of Boy Scouts of America, which is certainly commendable. Gates is about 70 years old. As you get older, I think there's a lot of benefit to being around young people. I greatly value my involvement with Carthage College for that reason, and I fear that Mr. Gates, far more senior, invisible figure than me, or most people, I think perhaps he's becoming too much of a grumpy old man, and I hope being around younger people at the Scouts will be helpful for him. That's
all right.
about all I can say on the subject.
Art Sear, thanks.
Thank you. It's always a tonic, Mitch. I really mean that.
Art Sear is Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's our occasional foreign policy contributor, and he spoke with Mitch Tyke. Although she says she's retiring, Deb Lowen of Wild Space Dance Company keeps making work in unexpected places around Milwaukee. We'll talk with her about her upcoming program, Sight Readings, when Lake Effect returns next on WUWM.